Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking about science, specifically scientific research, and moves by the Trump administration to make deep cuts in funding. DOGE-initiated layoffs at the National Science Foundation had already begun when a federal judge recently extended an injunction to prevent hundreds from being let go. Closer to home, what will this upheaval and uncertainty mean for Ohio State University, the largest research university in the state? Ohio State professor Chris Orban is a computational plasma physicist and a educational researcher serving the Marion and Columbus campuses. He's also a member of Stand Up for Science Ohio State, which is an independent group not sanctioned by the university. He wrote an opinion column in the Dispatch over the weekend that is titled, "We are watching what's happening to American science in horror." Welcome to All Sides, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a big honor to be here. I wish we had better news to share.
And also joining us is Jessica Turner, an Ohio State professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior, whose research has been funded by the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. Welcome to All Sides, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Chris, let's start with you. You've called Ohio a scientific powerhouse. Why use that term?
There's all kinds of institutions. Battelle is here. Ohio State is here. Abbott Labs is here. And I got to meet a lot of different people from across the state at the state, not state science fair, international science fair. It was at the Columbus Convention Center just a couple of weeks ago. And I point out in the Columbus Dispatch article is that the International Science Fair looks for places that have a lot of scientists that work there because they need judges. They need hundreds and hundreds of judges to judge a science fair. And Ohio is a place that they went. When I competed in International Science Fair in high school, they did it in Silicon Valley for the same reason. So Ohio has a lot to be proud of in terms of science and technology.
Now, there's a lot of turmoil happening right now. President Trump's budget calls for a 55% reduction in the funding for the National Science Foundation, but Congress needs to vote on that. DOGE started to lay off hundreds, but a judge halted that. So, Chris, can you recall another time when funding or the threat of interruption of funding or similar reductions in federal dollars has been this extreme?
The only thing in my entire career that you can compare this to is when Ted Cruz shut down the government during the Obama administration over a protest over Obamacare. That halted federal grants for weeks, things like that. And one of the interesting things that happened in the wake of that is that the National Science Foundation tried to provide the researchers with the funding up front as much as they could for fear that this might happen again, and here we are.
Hmm. Now, last year, faculty-led research grants brought in over $770 million to Ohio State. Can you give us an idea of the types of research that that funded?
It's all over the map. I mean, any department that you can think of at Ohio State is going to be funded by a lot of that research. I happened to lead a National Science Foundation study on plasma physics. And then Jessica can talk about the National Institutes of Health and all the funding that brings to campus.
Yes, Jessica, you receive funding from the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation for years. Can you tell us how that money has shaped your work?
Oh, I've been funded since I was an undergraduate in the research experience for undergraduates and graduate fellowships. And then I had VA funding to study spinal cord injuries. And then I've had NIH funding to look at severe mental illnesses and neuroimaging and genetics. It's been the only way to do this kind of research because these are very expensive approaches to use, and you need very large samples in order to do the work robustly and carefully.
Now, can you tell me, I think it seems if you read between the lines of the Trump administration and the DOGE initiative that they want maybe more private funding to be out there. They don't want the federal government having their hands in all of these pockets. Is it possible for you to find private funding as opposed to using federal funds?
No. In a word. Okay. There's been a number of reviews of this in terms of the level of support just the NIH makes to international scientific research, as well as what the private industry can contribute. For example, Pelotonia is a huge sponsor of research in cancer and at OSU, and they give $26 million a year. That's nowhere near the $770 that Ohio has been, you know, using. There's also the issue that the NIH budget is just so much larger than anyone else in the world. The next largest funder is the Wellcome Trust, and they don't come anywhere near it by an order of magnitude, you know, multiply by 10 at the minimum in order to get to the a matching. So there is just no money available in that space. There's also the issue of the difference is in how private corporations would fund research as opposed to how the government would fund research. Private corporations have to watch the bottom line and have to watch return on investment and have to watch the shareholders take on things. The government can actually fund science with a long-term view to say, you know, we know it takes decades to get from initial research findings to to clinical impact, to actually changing how we do things and actually fixing people's, you know, illnesses and making their lives better. And that is not something that many corporations are willing to put on the line.
Now, Chris, according to a press release put out by your organization, so far over $10 million of OSU's active or recently awarded federal funding has been rescinded, with $40 million worth of projects being interrupted. So $10 million, $40 million, that's not nothing. That's real money. But it's only a fraction of $770 million from last year. So can a lot of the research continue at this point, or is it just feel so in flux that we're not sure?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the project. So some of the projects were close to the end, and they might not be impacted as heavily. Other projects are close to the beginning. Other projects are doing some sort of long-term study, and now maybe they can't publish what they wanted to publish because they've been told by the federal government to stop doing the research. So even though the money hasn't been clawed back in some grants, that's the way that they're interfered, is they can't do the research. But thanks for highlighting the press release.
Yes, and you were very clear in your press release that you are not representing the Ohio State Administration. You are separate from them. You're speaking out separate from the Ohio State Administration.
Correct.
But what has the Ohio State Administration said to researchers around campus about how to handle this less funding or where money is coming from?
Well, one of the craziest things that happened in the last couple of months is that at one point, Ohio State told professors to stop applying for certain federal grants. So as it talks about in the press release, on May 2nd, an email went out to many professors saying that because of the changes to overhead, so a reduction of a fourfold of the overhead that the federal government can pay, for now, just don't apply for federal grants. Never in my entire career have been told to stop working towards federal grants as a professor.
And did they tell you to stop because it's going to be unreliable, or did they tell you to stop because I guess I don't know why?
Well, it's because it would cost too much to do the research than what the federal government would be able to give us, because the overhead helps to keep our facilities going, the equipment going.
So Ohio State was worried about having to foot the bill for if there was a gap in money.
Right.
Okay. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about research funding cuts with Ohio State professors Chris Orban and Jessica Turner. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about was the Trump administration wants to slash NASA's budget, and that could affect a huge telescope project that Ohio State has been heavily involved in. It's known as the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. I read that it's designed to survey the sky hundreds of times faster than the Hubble Space Telescope and the James Webb Space Telescope. Now, what exactly, can you tell me a little bit more about this telescope? Nancy Grace Roman is not the TV personality that comes to mind when you hear Nancy Grace, but can you tell me more about this telescope and what would it mean if we lose the money for it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, it's so close to being launched that it was planned to be launched into space in October of 2026. Telescopes all put together, it's been through a whole bunch of tests. It just has some minor things they still need to do. And there's a great Dispatch article highlighting the impact of that telescope on Ohio State's astronomy department. It's one of the biggest projects we've ever been a part of.
I wanted to talk for a minute about students, because there's the idea that, I mean, you know, Ohio State University is a teaching facility. So there's a lot of people doing research who do that for a living, like like you, Jessica. But also, you're teaching the next generation of researchers and scientists. What do you worry about when it comes to funding for even graduate students or other or student projects?
I worry about it a great deal. We talked a little bit about the indirect and costs, and I think it's really important that you understand the part of the ecosystem that the research that research funding plays, because direct costs cover the costs of doing the research in terms of the salaries of the people involved, the equipment that might need to be bought, but the indirects cover the buildings, the programs, the maintenance, all of the other things that the U.S. government has said the universities will chip in, right, and cover that, so we don't have to have major labs, you know, huge labs in order to do this. Part of what we do is we use the research funding at the local universities to fund our graduate students, to fund undergraduate research opportunities, or to have that as volunteer opportunities for the students to be able to get their foot in the door and understand how research works. It's used to fund, in some cases, the medical residencies, and sort of understand how people will cover their time off from the clinic so that they can actually train the next generation of medical doctors and things like that. That funding comes from a lot of different places, but as the budget is impacted, those opportunities and programs are impacted. And as both Chris and I can tell you, it's very important to get started in research as an undergraduate, as a high schooler, et cetera, and to keep that going, because there's just not enough opportunities as it is. And cutting back on those has significant impact. And then we also have the issue of people currently in graduate school saying, where do I go? And looking abroad, as we've already discussed, you know, previously, looking abroad to say, if there are no options in the United States, should I be going to Canada? Should I be going to Europe? Should I be looking at South America? Should I be looking at other places?
Chris, you wrote another opinion piece that was in the Ohio Capital Journal. It was called "Doge Cuts to Science Will Impact Ohio Students." The university did reduce graduate admissions this year. Do you think, is that in reaction to these federal cuts?
Absolutely. I mean, I was on the graduate admissions committee for the physics department, and I've done that a couple of years. And this is the third year I've done it, and the two other years, this is not how it went. So I can't tell you the exact numbers that things have been pulled back, but it's already had an impact. Some schools have actually rescinded offers for PhD programs. Thankfully, Ohio State has not done that, or at least it hasn't done it yet. But if I was a graduate student now, I don't know I'd be sitting here as a professor having to weather all this.
And I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about international students. The Trump administration is looking to revoke the visas for international students, specifically from China. Can either of you speak to what international students bring to research at Ohio State?
My experience with international students has been largely at other institutions, but the general idea is the same. International students bring a unique perspective, a unique sense of background, a complementary set of skills in many cases to what American students or local students will bring. So they can actually round out a research program very nicely by bringing in innovation that isn't necessarily something that would be locally trained. On the other hand, they also help build the international research programs later and international collaborations that, again, are needed in many cases to make the kinds of progress we want to make.
And can I comment on that? So as an American graduate student, I worked harder knowing that there's folks who, some of the brightest minds in the world, want to come here to Ohio State, and we're turning them away. I mean, there's quite a few Chinese undergraduates studying physics at Ohio State, which is great. They all pay out-of-state tuition, which we're grateful for. I review the PhD applications for the physics programs, and these people that are applying to be a part of what we're doing here are just incredible.
Now, Chris, you call your group Stand Up for Science Ohio State, but again, you're not affiliated or authorized to speak for Ohio State University. But what do you wish Ohio State would say something? Do they have some sway with DOGE, with the National Science Foundation? I mean, they're the largest university for research in the state.
Well, I think the strategy from their point is that President Carter's strategy is that he's going to keep a low profile. He's going to try to rely on the fact that J.D. Vance is an OSU graduate to try to weather this thing. That's one strategy. Mayan's the opposite strategy. To try to say what most of us professors are thinking about what's going on.
And there's also this idea of the big tech alliance, academic alliance. So Big Ten universities, Ohio State, Indiana, Michigan, Penn State, could all work together either to find funding or work together to talk to the federal government. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, the University Senate voted to join this Big Ten alliance. And I would say Ohio State is towards the front of the list to get the kind of negative attention from, so like Harvard, for example, mm-hmm. almost every grant from Harvard has been canceled. I mean, not every grant is from Ohio State's been canceled. It's still a small fraction, but Harvard is a different story. And when they're done with Harvard, they're going to come for institutions like us. I'm glad that they voted to join the Big Ten alliance. I don't know if it's going to be as helpful as we hope it will, but we'll see.
All right. Well, I guess we'll just have to stay tuned and see what happens with the funding. Maybe you could come back in a couple of months and update me on how things are going at the start of the school year.
Hopefully more good news, I suppose.
Let's hope so.
Let's hope so. That was Chris Orban, a computational plasma physicist at Ohio State, and also a member of Stand Up for Science Ohio State, and also Jessica Turner, professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at Ohio State. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And coming up, we're going to talk about whether terminally ill patients should be allowed to try experimental drugs that lack FDA approval. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jarovich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Receiving news that you have a terminal illness is absolutely devastating. For many, the first steps are weighing their options and spending time with loved ones. However, some here in Ohio are calling for another option to be made available to terminal patients. The Right to Try movement calls for allowing those with a terminal illness to access experimental treatments that have not yet been approved by the FDA, but could have a dramatic effect on their recovery. Joining me now is Elijah Stacey, a patient's right advocate. Elijah, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us a little more, give us some context about what the Right to Try movement wants to have happen specifically?
Yeah, so the Right to Try for individualized treatments, what we want to do is take the Right to Try even one step further. If you remember back in 2018, it was passed under the Trump administration in the first term. But what we want to do here on the state level, and what we have been doing in other states, is this legislation allows patients to get drugs even if there isn't that safety data, right? And that's really important because when you have a terminal illness, sometimes there's drugs that are looking really good. There's a lot of maybe preclinical work that has been done, but it's not fully, you know, tested yet in humans to be deemed safe. But, you know, there's a really good chance that you could take it and it can make a big difference and perhaps save your life. We want that option. We want to be able to take that. And so that's what we're advocating for and hoping to get passed in Ohio as well.
And so this idea of Right to Try, it's not just trying anything at random. It has to be something that's already in a study, but maybe just hasn't made it to FDA approval.
So what this would do is your doctor would have to be willing to get behind it. The manufacturer would have to be willing to give it to you. And then you'd have to be willing to take it. So there, you know, it's not just anything goes. Your doctor, the person closest to you that knows you medically the best, they would have to be the one that gets behind it.
And how is it determined who could potentially qualify for Right to Try? Is it just between the patient and the doctor?
Yeah, if you have a fatal illness and you don't have much time to, you know, live, if it's a terminal disease, then you would be eligible for this treatment.
Do you have any examples of life-threatening illnesses that this law would allow treatment for?
Sure. If you look at the disease that I have, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and it's a really good example for individualized treatments. You're lacking dystrophin, which is in the dystrophin gene, the largest gene in the body, and it's coded with 79 exons, which are the coding regions. And so everyone's mutation is unique to them and it's going to be different. And so perhaps you have a treatment that would work for this person in this part of the gene and this person in another part of the gene, and then maybe for me in this part of the gene, right? Because everyone's mutation is different. That would then work for an illness like that, and it makes a lot of sense. And that's probably the way in which you'd have to go about actually curing the disease.
Now, the federal right to try laws you mentioned were passed a few years ago, but can you go to other states and be able to try things? Is it just Ohio that's holding you back?
Well, we want to do this across other states to give them more medical freedom. Like I said, that you don't need that phase one safety data already in place. So, if you don't go to a state where red try for individualized treatments has been passed, then the answer is no. That because that'd be the federal law, right? But we're hoping that patients don't have to leave, especially with a terminal illness. It's hard to travel. They may not have the energy to travel, and their doctor, who knows them best, is probably in the state where they reside.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Elijah Stacey, a patient rights advocate, about the right to try. What sorts of medications would immediately be allowed if there was approval for this law? Are there things out there that are lacking FDA approval, but like or a lot of people want to try?
Well, what I would say as a biotech consultant, someone that's close to the injury, at least for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, is that we're entering the golden age of medicine. I hear about other indications as well, and so many breakthroughs are happening. And so it's kind of hard to pinpoint one exactly, but what comes to mind is things like gene editing or different types of gene therapies, or perhaps it's even a small molecule drug. We've seen a lot happening there too. That could benefit patients. The way I see it is, if a patient is 1 month short, because that safety data is going to come out 1 month later, and they didn't get to live even though that drug is there, they should have that option, right? It's not right that, just because they were, born at a certain time where they're going to be 1 month short, that we don't give them access to something that can change their life and also affect their loved ones as well. Because, when a patient is suffering, it doesn't just affect the patient, but all those around them.
Now, is it the FDA has too many rules of the way they do their trials, or is it that the FDA is too slow in some aspects, and that's why some people don't get the chance to try?
Well, a lot of it doesn't even have to do with the FDA. I mean, of course, right? I think like every American, right? We want, good regulation. We want safe drugs. We want effective drugs. And the FDA does its part. But science sometimes, it just takes time to evaluate the safety and whatever. And so, sometimes patients, can't wait that long. They should have the option that, no one's forced to do this if they don't want to, but at least they should have that option, to throw the Hail Mary. And hopefully have something that makes their life better.
Now, when throwing the Hail Mary, who pays for it? Will insurance companies cover the cost of an experimental drug?
The manufacturer would probably give the drug to the patient, right? They'd be the one that is supplying the drug. So, I don't really think that you'd even have to bring in, from my knowledge, any type of insurance company or anything like that to cover it.
Okay, so do you know if insurance companies would cover experimental drugs if you would try to apply it through?
So that's something that I would not know. And I think it would probably be really the manufacturer, because I'm pretty sure, from what I understand, right? So I think insurance companies really just cover what has already been approved. Because I know that even, like, for example, when it comes to some approved therapies, they don't even cover necessarily all the new approved therapies, right? It kind of takes time for it to get into their system. So it's hard for me to imagine they'd cover something that's purely experimental.
So, do pharmaceutical companies have something to gain from allowing these treatments to be approved? I mean, does it gets them more research as well, I guess.
Perhaps you can have, first in human data, and it's something, right? But I mean, in terms of actually getting a drug approved, I mean, you need statistical power, is what we call it, in terms of clinical trials, and that's needed. So you can't just go off of an antidote. But I mean, doing an experiment in a human is very valuable information. So there is something to gain, somewhat, right, to better understand. But it's not going to necessarily lead to, a drug approval. So a lot of it is just being good-hearted and being humanitarian.
Are there safety concerns for the patients and the loved ones over this right to try? What if it doesn't work and it makes things worse?
Well, what I would say with a terminal illness, you're already going to get worse no matter what. That's the guarantee. But if you do some kind of medical intervention, there's at least a chance that it doesn't. And so, you are taking that risk when you do it. But I mean, what I would reassure the listener is that there's a lot of medications that mechanistically look like they're going to be completely safe, and there's good reason scientifically to think they're safe. And there's a lot of things that doctors can do when trying out an experimental treatment, depending on what it is. But you can sometimes reverse the course when the drug is given to the patient. So, again, as speaking as somebody with a terminal illness, if it was me, I want to try because I know I'm going to get worse. I know the quality of life I'm living. And, I quite frankly have nothing to lose, right? I'm already going to lose my life. Might as well try something. Maybe it makes me lose my life as well, but I was going to lose my life anyway, so just might as well go for it.
Yes, I mean, what am I to say? I'm sorry that you have a terminal illness. I can't even imagine. And so you mentioned earlier the drug that you are hopeful to take. Have you found a way to be able to take it? Or is it? Is that is it? Are you working for toward yourself too?
Yeah, so I mean, there's definitely drugs that I'm eyeing. Duchenne is a complicated disease where you kind of need multiple drugs, right? Just to tell you a little bit about the disease, it's a muscle wasting disease, right? And so, skeletal muscle as well as cardiac muscle are affected. So, you got to worry about pulmonary issues because skeletal muscle will make up like your diaphragm and intercostal muscles. Those are what you do to breathe, right? But then you also, the heart is a muscle too. So, you might need medication that works a little bit different in cardiac tissue versus skeletal. So there's a lot of drugs that I'm eyeing and wanting to get on, and 100% gonna do whatever it takes to get those drugs.
So you're advocating for more people besides just you to be able to do this, but for your drugs that you're eyeing right now, what do you need to do or what needs to change for you to be able to take them starting tomorrow?
Yeah, no, 100%. I'm definitely wanting to do this for everybody involved. I care a lot. I honestly think living with this disease has made me a more empathetic person, and just wanting to do good for people with all kinds of diseases, or honestly just hardship in general. But you ask about me personally. Again, there's not a whole lot of things that I think has a really good shot yet that I would want to take. Some more than others for sure. But we just have to. We have to wait, and again, doctor has to be willing, manufacturer has to be willing to give the drug, and then I could, move forward with it.
Now, are there other, can you give me an example besides your illness that you were talking about? Is there another illness where you have heard about the right to try and it has helped, it's worked?
You can really go down the list, right? I mean, there's cancer patients, there's you can even look at like ALS. I know there's other kinds of like expanded access kind of programs, right, which would fall into this as well. This would maybe go even faster for them. So I mean, there's a lot of terminal illnesses that are just terrible. There's unique illnesses that perhaps, right, and this is a really key point that I want people to know. There's a lot of illnesses that maybe aren't that large where there's, big clinical studies actually taking place, but there's a university like the Ohio State University, that could develop drugs specifically for that patient and study it there. That would work here. And that, that's offering that legal pathway, which is tremendous hope for a patient that is suffering with a very, very, very rare disease.
Who are some of the main opponents to this right to try movement? Who's standing in your way?
Quite honestly, it's a very bipartisan piece of legislation. I always say, there's no red diseases, there's no blue diseases, there's just human diseases, and that's why we need to cure them. I honestly haven't really found anyone that opposes this. It just seems like common sense. Most people I talk to, whether on the right or the left, go, yeah, I like that. And that's something, when we live in more polarizing times, I think it's important for us to find common ground and things that we all agree on. And at the end of the day, we all want our loved ones, ourselves to be healthy and to live a fulfilling life.
And I guess there are major studies happening, but it has to be, for lack of a better word, I guess, a more well-known disease. So the rarer your disease, the more likely there are to be fewer medications known to work for it. Is that the truth?
Somewhat, right? I mean, again, like some biotech companies will go on and take on very rare diseases and make that their whole mission, and they found a lot of success. But sometimes you have a disease that's so rare that they don't even know other patients with it, right? Like I've actually met some, and it's hard to find even the natural history, which you need to do science, right? Like what normally happens and everything like that. So again, like for the people that are here now, maybe we can develop them a drug that would work for their unique genetic mutation as opposed to waiting 100 years when we better understand the disease and then, could develop a drug that will work for that disease for every single person that we have studied, if that makes sense.
Yes. So what if you have support on the red side and the blue side, what's your next step? What can our listeners do if they wanted to help? What's the next step with the Right to Try movement?
Yeah, it would be very much appreciated. You can write your assembly members, your senators, your governor, and urge them to support this, right? I'm sure everybody has probably known someone in their life that has suffered from some kind of illness. So, the importance of this and just think about the future. That's what I like to think about a lot is that future people, will have a better life than I have because of the work I'm doing. And that's what really motivates me.
Well, I wish you all the best, and thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the Right to Try movement. That was Elijah Stacey, a patient rights advocate. Thanks for being here, Elijah.
Thank you so much for having me, and go Bucks.
And yeah, I feel like saying OH to you. There you go. Yeah. Coming up, we are talking about an AI phone bot that may or may not help you with a question about your Social Security. And that's when All Sides and Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Tech Tuesday. AI is everywhere now, whether it's good or bad. From Social Security phone bots to scammers trying to replicate your voice, it seems like AI can do just about anything. Joining us now to talk about it is Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So Social Security is trying out a new AI phone bot that may or may not work. So what is this phone bot and what are they trying to do with it? What's it supposed to be doing?
Yes. So if you've ever had to call the Social Security Administration in the past, there's usually a couple of like voice prompts that you go through about which department you need to go to for whatever reason, and then you're on hold for a bit until you talk to a person. As a result, or in addition to the folks who were laid off from the Social Security Administration over the last couple of months, a new AI system was put in place to help answer some of those easier to ask questions, like, when am I expected to, get my next payment? Or, who do I talk to if there was, a change of address or something like that? The idea was for a lot of those simpler tasks to be handled automatically. Unfortunately, we are about a month into this system being deployed, and there are very few people who have nice things to say about this new system.
Yes. Is it similar to phone bots we would interact with if we call, like our phone company or a cable company, that kind of thing?
It's probably the closest thing that I can relate it to is close to the system that you would get if you were trying to call your cable company or your phone company from about 10 years ago.
Oh, great. Okay. So my next question was, is it working well? And I guess the answer is no.
No, in fact, there have been several reports from not just investigative reports that have gone into to trying to navigate the system, but users who have repeatedly referred to the system as maddening.
Okay. Well, the article in CNET also quotes someone from the Washington Post. A Washington Post reporter tried out the bot and by asking it about not receiving a Social Security check, which seems like an important question. How did the bot deal with this request?
The bot responded by, delivering a pre-programmed message on the delivery schedule for the check and when the next one can be expected, and did not address the missing payment at all.
And was the reporter able to eventually get it to work correctly after more than one attempt?
Yeah, this is where the analogy to voice systems from 10 years ago comes into play. It seems the trick to getting anything that you want from this system is to just repeatedly ask to speak to an agent.
Okay, so you just have to say agent, agent until you get a real person on the phone?
That, yes. We performed several tests ourselves, as well as reports from the Washington Post and the New York Times, and the general conclusion seems to be if you want actual information, or if you want to, you know, what is actually happening with your specific account, you still very much need to, you know, go through that system and wait on hold until you talk to a person.
So why did the Social Security Administration do this? Why'd they put the money into it? I mean, what do they have to say for themselves?
Conventional wisdom from people who are not familiar with how these systems actually work is that AI is the future. And so an AI system that could handle these calls would be less expensive in order to, you know, release people and save money. And the general thought here was that by being able to answer some of those easier to answer questions, that there would need to be fewer humans involved in that process. But if that's going to be the case, it's going to take quite some time for the system to get upgraded to a point where it can actually, you know, take care of folks in the way that they're used to from other systems from other companies today.
Okay. So is it just that the federal government, or specifically the Social Security Administration, is behind the times? Do you think they'll stick with it and it'll get better?
I think the current administration will stick with this as a cost-cutting measure until there is pressure, from one direction or another to improve or change that system.
And didn't I also read that even saying the word agent, you don't get put in queue to talk to a human right away? Sometimes it seemed like it was ignoring the word agent a couple of times.
So when we tried to basically game the system in order to see how quickly we could get to an agent, it required 6 different prompts for an agent before we were eventually routed to the system that said, please wait on hold for the next available person.
Oh, heavens. Okay. Well, I guess hopefully I don't have any questions for the Social Security Administration in the next year or two. Maybe they can get it upgraded. We'll see. The next topic we're going to talk to is Google Photos, which is now 10 years old. And during its lifetime, it has had over 1.5 billion users. To celebrate its 10 years, they're updating the photo editing abilities in their app. And one new photo editing feature that was previously exclusive just to Pixel phones is the auto frame. So can you tell me about Google Photos and, you know, what it's doing to celebrate its 10 years?
Yeah, so Google Photos has been around for, like you said, just about a decade now. It'll be 10 years next week. And it was born out of a desire to, you know, use some of the things that Google does best with, you know, search and categorization and you know, object recognition to make a system that was just easier to search for things. So if you wanted to look up a specific person in your contacts list or a specific event, it is to this day the easiest way to, you know, look through a collection of photos on your phone in order to find like a specific event or, you know, a specific thing. Even if you just remember that the thing you're looking for is a specific color, I have found success being like, it was a blue thing. And, you know, I scroll for a little bit and I find the thing that I'm actually looking for. Search is by far the thing that makes this, one of the best tools. It is something that I recommend that people install on iPhones because it is far better at search than Apple's built-in photo system. Mm-hmm. But, you know, over time, Google has added a ton of features to this platform, and included in that is a radically updated way to edit photos, in some cases automatically. And with that, over the last couple of years, has also included AI tools to do things like add, automatic blur to the background, so it looks like you've taken, you know, a more artsy shot, or to, in some cases, change the color of the skyline. If you would prefer that the photo look like you took it in the evening or during, you know, the golden hour or something like that. In some cases, that can be artificially done. And of course, the fan favorite, especially when Google does this on stage, is if you've got a picture with someone else and that someone else is not in your life anymore, you can kind of wiggle your finger over that person on the screen and Google will simply edit it out of the photo.
Now, the AI enhancements you're talking about, is that one of the features is called Reimagine? Is that right?
Yes. So reimagine is very much, you can highlight if you've got, a picture of a couple or a dog or something like that, but then the background is, maybe not ideal. You can ask Google to reimagine that background. So if you would like it to look like you are on a beach or, something like that, you can make that specific request, or you can simply do it randomly and let Google's AI system choose something that is best based on the colors and items that are in the foreground.
Do any pictures that you edit with AI, well, do they get labeled automatically that AI was used? Or if you do it yourself, then there's no labeling?
No, so there is, Google Photos has always maintained the ability to either edit the photo directly and save that photo, or to create a new version of that photo with the edits that you have made in it. And if you choose that second option in the actual photo details, it will say that it has been manipulated by AI.
Now, the app itself is also getting a redesign to match the visual overhaul that happened with the Android 16. So, what are some of the improvements? What will the app look like now?
A lot of it comes down to, sliding tools that are a little easier to understand. If you want an image to be slightly brighter, or if you want the foreground to have, greater shadows or something like that, there are a bunch of manual tools that you can go in and access. They've never been particularly user-friendly, and so Google is trying to, give it a visual refresh so that it's easier to make those changes yourself instead of relying on some of the auto changes that are available within the tool.
And it's interesting for me for you to say that Google has a better search function than Apple, because I have an Apple phone and I have str I thought it was just me, but I have struggled to find a picture that I am looking for in the Apple search. Is it just not that great?
It has never been particularly great. It's tough to, to process a lot of that data. It's, one of the benefits that Google has over Apple in this situation is that every photo that you put within Google Photos is backed up to Google Photos Cloud, which means it has access to a greater set of computing powers to search for things, as long as you are connected to the internet, obviously. Whereas Apple focuses on local data privacy entirely, and so you are limited to the compute power of your phone in order to search for whatever is on your phone. And the difference there is staggering on a like side by side comparison.
Interesting. So if I have, but if I have Apple's iCloud, that it's not searching there for my photos, or?
It'll perform the backup, but no, it doesn't rely on iCloud to do any computing.
Well, no wonder it can't find the cat I was looking for when I was looking for a cat. It kept showing me penguins.
Yep.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking about tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. CNET recently did a survey that found that 96% of Americans receive at least one scam message each week. I get way more than that, by the way. But
Yes.
anyway, why do so many of us get scam messages?
A lot of it is just that the regulations surrounding who is able to sell your data has just changed over the last 10 years. And so the ability to get access to phone numbers, in a lot of cases, it's data that we have given away. You can't scroll particularly far on Facebook without finding some sort of, give me your phone number, and you get a 20% off discount code for, a random online store. All of that data is more or less open season, when you share it to these third parties and you don't know, what that data is connected to. So there are massive international operations to just scrape up as many of those phone numbers as possible, and then, just kind of throw stuff at the wall and see what scams hit. One of the more popular ones over the last couple of years have surrounded, toll violations when, driving through, highways that have toll booths or bridges and things that have toll booths. It is not uncommon anymore to get text messages that say that, you have an unpaid, toll that is due from a random phone number, and then, that turns out to not be something that is actually from the local government, and in fact leads you into a scam. And there are so many other versions of this that exist, but that is the most popular one right now.
Are you did surveys of people asking if they get scam emails, scam phone calls, scam text messages. Are emails the worst culprit, or is it becoming more and more texts and phone calls?
Email is certainly the greatest in volume, but it's the least likely to end in a scam where someone has lost money, because it's just, we have had scam emails for longer than at least a couple of the people listening to the show have been alive. And so, you know, it's just the kind of thing where it's kind of baked in, right? You are more likely to question that something in your email box is a scam as opposed to a text message that you've received.
Now, I was looking at your percentages of people who say they receive at least one scam text message a week. What if I'm getting one a day? Did I just screw something up along the way? And my phone number's everywhere.
No, you know, in fact, it's probably the opposite that is true, is that because you have likely never engaged with one of those, that there are just more groups trying to get your attention.
Oh, wait. So if I answer, will they stop calling or they call
more?
If you answer
and then very specifically do not engage in the scam part, then there is some anecdotal evidence to suggest that that decreases the number of texts that you would get for a little while.
What about the old school do not call list? Is that just non-existent anymore?
Yeah, it's non-existent anymore. It's really not a thing. There are some tools that are available to some folks to make this a little easier. Google has worked really hard on the phone system within Android phones, where there is a, you know, kind of known scam phone call database in order to you know, kind of block things out on that level, but that is not currently available to you if you have an iPhone. Apple has never been super successful at this. There are some efforts that you can go through with your carrier, you know, be it Verizon, AT&T, or whoever, where you can choose to only have your phone ring if it's a number that's on your contact list. So you know right away that it is not a known number, and so your phone doesn't ring. In that case, it just sends them straight to voicemail. There are a few, you know, kind of mitigating tools that are available, but there is no silver bullet to these right now.
Whenever the phone number comes up and says potential spam, how does it know that?
It's part of a shared database that the carriers have. You know, so AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon.
Verizon doing that for me, saying potential spam.
That's right. Yeah, so it is flagged that and put it there. But even that database is you know, wildly incomplete.
So are most phone calls that are flagged as potential spam, are most of them actually are spam, or do you have to answer to find out?
No, a vast majority of them are actually spam, mm-hmm. and it is the result of, you know, a certain number of people reporting the number that has called them as spam, so that mm-hmm. the carrier has that report. And I think the last time I checked, the number is four or more. So if four or more people have reported a number as scam, then it gets entered into that database. For it to be used. It probably varies from carrier to carrier, but if memory serves, that's how Verizon is currently operating. So if you get a call and it's not a number you recognize, or you do answer the phone and it turns out that it's scam, there is an option to report that within your phone or within the calling app, and that can help in some ways. But you'll notice if you get a lot of scam calls every day, it's very rarely the same number.
Right. So if you take the time, though, for each of those calls to click the button where it says report junk, that would help.
Yeah, I mean, it's really not an ideal situation, but it is true that if all of us took 30 seconds out of our day and, you know, went through at the end of the day and reported all of the numbers that we got that were, you know, not friends, that it would, you know, help the community as a whole. But that is the kind of thing that it just takes time. And unfortunately, we do not have a governing body that is stepping in to address this right now.
And if you block the number, it doesn't really matter, because a different number will call you 2 minutes later.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Well, I don't think we're going to solve anything here with that. But I wanted to end, as we have for the past few weeks, with your CNET tariff tracker. Do you have any updates on the tariff tracker? Because last week we talked about whether some of the things you were seeing were artificially inflated Memorial Day pricing.
That's exactly right. And one thing that we've been tracking over the last 2 weeks that we have seen increase really incredibly has been name brand antihistamines. So if you are currently buying things like Claritin or you know, it's, you know, competing products, in some cases, the prices of those have gone up to as much as 50 cents a pill, depending on where you get it from. If you buy in bulk from places like Costco or things like that, then it can be down to something like 30 cents. But that same price increase does not apply to off brands that do the same thing. So if you look at, I believe the Claritin knockoff is loratadine, those prices have not increased. And we have some of our wellness folks are currently talking to professionals to identify why that is. Mm-hmm. But if you do find that, you know, the price in your area for antihistamines have just gone up a ton, take a look at some of the off brands and you'll likely find that those prices have not increased the same.
Now, is this related to tariffs or is it just companies taking advantage of allergy season?
It's not immediately clear. Some of these pharmaceutical companies are not always incredibly upright about where these things come from, whether they enter the U.S. or if they are manufactured here in the U.S. Or if they are simply bottled here in the U.S. So it's a thing that we're looking into. But for the moment, the one thing that we know for sure is that just about everywhere in the U.S., the price of those have gone up pretty considerably.
All right. Well, Russell, thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk to you again. More tariff tracker updates to come. That was Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thank you to the All Sides staff, Senior Producer Marcus Charleston, Producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, Student Producers Chris Corcoran, David Stein, Iza Huck, and Colin Simpson. Video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard, and today by Dalton Jones. Thank you, Dalton. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.